Welcome, everyone. We're talking with Melvin Dumar, Gary Magnuson, Stuart Stein, and Ron Greening about the 32-year-old battle over the estate of late billionaire Howard Hughes. Melvin, let me ask you, is it possible that it wasn't Howard Hughes out there, that it was just a guy that looked like Howard Hughes, and that someone and the rest of the facts that go along with this are kind of coincidental? Have you thought about that over the years? Okay. Can we try? Gary, let me try. Are you there?
Yes,
can
I
we
am.
Hear you? Gary, I'll hit you with the same question. Is it possible it wasn't Hughes? It was just somebody who looked like him? And I know that you've had other people over the years who've come forward and said, yeah, that was me out there. It wasn't Howard Hughes.
Well, that would be the case when I first started on this investigation. But I think there is too much corroboration now at this point. I think the corroborative evidence proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was Howard Hughes. Robert Darrow's testimony, his statement that it was Howard Hughes, that he worked for Howard Hughes. He flew him up there. He lost him up there. And shortly thereafter, Melvin picked him up. And all of the other information we've talked about, I don't think there's any doubt about that now.
You've had other wills come forward that have been proven to be absolute fakes, right?
Yes.
A bunch?
Yeah, I think I have reviewed as many as about 15, 20 various wills that people, some of them were done as jokes. For example, one will came in and said that this is the last will and testament of Howard Hughes, and I want to give all my money to the Boy Scouts so that they can go to my casinos and play the slot machines. And then there was a lady in London that said she shared a sandwich with Howard Hughes during Second World War, and therefore he had written the will and given her all of his money and so on and so forth. So a lot of those could be washed out immediately. There were others that were attempts at legitimate wills, but they never gained any traction and were never seriously looked at by the courts.
Okay, we're going to try to go back to the phones and see if they're working now. East of the Rockies, Russ in Buffalo, you still there? How about we go west of the Rockies, Mike in Modesto. Mike, are you there? Okay, we're having problems with the calls. I'm going to go back to our guests. Gary, help me with this. Were polygraphs ever used in the course of the investigation, either yours or the earlier inquiries by the courts?
Yeah, the earlier inquiry, there were polygraphs given. Melvin was polygraphed twice. The first time he was polygraphed, he was found to be deceptive, even on such things as his name and where he lived. So he was a nervous wreck when he took that first polygraph. The second polygraph was administered by the same polygrapher who determined that Melvin was not deceptive and was telling the truth about picking up the old man and in the desert and the old man saying that he was Howard Hughes.
Wasn't there also a polygraph given to this guy, Forsyth, who claimed to have been the one who delivered the Mormon will to Melvin at the gas station?
Yes, I believe so. But polygraphs are not admissible in court unless both sides agree to it. And so those polygraphs were basically for the attorneys to determine whether or not Melvin was legitimately telling the truth.
Let's talk to our attorneys for a second. There was another name that came up in the whole Howard Hughes organization. He also was an attorney. His name was Chester Davis. Have you looked at him as being a participant in the kinds of things you're trying to get to the bottom of, Stuart?
Well, Chester Davis, I think, is gone now.
Yes.
But there is no question that he was allied with Bill Gates over the years. Remember what happened. After Howard Hughes died, you had Bill Lummis taking control of everything. He knew nothing about the organization, so he had to deal with Bill Gates and Chester Davis. And what Bill Gates and Chester Davis did is that they started putting themselves in control of various entities. And one of the entities that they put themselves in control of was the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And George, you may remember about that big lawsuit in Delaware where Lummis, as the executor of the Howard Hughes estate, sued Davis and Gay back from them so he could have it for himself. Ultimately, they compromised and they both controlled it after a while. And one of the other reasons that these things were secret for so many years, and Gary could confirm this, are those confidentiality agreements that the Hughes organization required everybody to sign before they left the organization. And on top of that, there were lifetime contracts given to all of the aides as their, what we believe is, their payoff for their perjured testimony at the trial. And then after the trial was over, it was Bill Lummis who sued these aides to try and set aside all those lifetime contracts. So these people have been fighting amongst each other, but they always seem to settle out with each other because they both have the goods on each other.
It gets pretty complicated. We're going to take a short break, see if we can figure out what's going on with our phone lines, and then we'll be right back with more of this discussion. And Melvin is going to be rejoining us as well. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. We're going to give another shot to go into the phone lines with our guests, Melvin Dumar, Gary Magnuson, Stuart Stein, and Ron Greening. We're going to go west of the Rockies. Mike in Modesto. Good morning, Mike. That's not happening. First-time caller. Want to try that one? Al in South Carolina. Good morning. Hello. Yeah, this is not working. We'll see if we can get that fixed, folks. Back to my guests. I will go back to Gary Magnuson. Gary, I want to talk about Johnny Meyer for a second. Now, this guy was one of the witnesses that you brought up who was an aide to Howard Hughes, who is one of the two people that you found had found Howard Hughes outside of the Desert Inn during that time period. Is that right? Is Gary there? Do we have any? Just let me know. Do we have any of our guests? We have no guests here right now. Okay. Well, we'll give it a couple of minutes and we'll see if we can fix this. In the meantime, I'll bring up a couple of other topics that I was going to talk to you if we had time to get into. This is a report out of CNN, completely unrelated to Howard Hughes, by the way, but it's about a group of experts from around the world held this first news conference about global catastrophic risks. And the basic thrust of the story is humans and machines merging in the future. The story goes like this. Some experts are saying that humans will merge with machines before the end of this century. They will discuss what should be done to prevent these risks from becoming realities. It could lead to the end of human life on Earth as we know it. There's a guy named Dr. Nick Bostrom, the director of Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute. He's the host of this symposium over there. And as he put it, any entity which is radically smarter than human beings would also be very powerful. If we get something wrong, you could imagine the consequences would involve the extinction of the human species. This global catastrophic risk conference had experts focusing on what could be the unintended consequences of new technologies, such as super intelligent machines that, if ill-conceived, might result in the demise of Homo sapiens. They call themselves transhumanists, according to Dr. Bostrom. They anticipate a coming era where biotechnology, molecular nanotechnologies, artificial intelligence, and other new types of cognitive tools could be used to amplify our intellectual capacity. So I think that's a good topic for a future Coast to Coast show. I'm told that we have Melvin and Gary back. I'm going to believe it when I hear it. So, Melvin, are you there?
I'm here now.
All right. I want to talk to you while we've got you here. You know, you had that movie experience. They made Melvin and Howard. It won a couple of Oscars. I think probably people would say, well, Melvin must have got rich off that movie experience. That wasn't the case, though, was it?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I didn't get hardly any money out of it to speak of. I got a tenth of what I should have because of them switching things around, the attorneys and stuff I had at the time. So,
were you on the set while this thing was being made? Did they use you as a consultant?
Just part of it, very, very limited. They were about half done with the movie before I even knew where they were filming or what they were doing.
And how did you feel about the portrayal of you in that movie? Paul LaMont played your part, and he was a very lovable kind of a guy.
Well, I think he did a good job. I wanted to play myself, but they said they had to have a professional actor play me, and so they didn't think I could play myself. So Paul and Matt, he's all right. In fact, he called me here not too long ago and asked me how I was doing. he's a good guy.
Really? Well, maybe if Stuart and Ron pound this through the courts, they'll have to make a new movie with a new happier ending.
Well, that certainly would be wonderful, and we would be sure this time that Melvin got his rightful share of any movie rights.
We were talking before our technical difficulties and before the break about Johnny Meyer. You know, Johnny Meyer is the guy who said that he saw Howard Hughes outside of the Desert Inn during that same time period. So his testimony is pretty important and something that Gary Magnuson was able to bring up. But I'll tell you, when I raised Johnny Meyer's name with some of the former Hughes aides, people like Gordon Margolis, they just sort of snicker, like they didn't find him to be a very credible person. Gary, what do you say about him?
Well, he's a strange guy in many ways. He, as I said earlier, purchased mines on behalf of the Howard Hughes Corporation, but most of the mines were barren. And so what would happen is they would, he and some cronies would find mines, and then they would have straw men buy the mines at a cheap price, and then they'd boost the price up exorbitantly, and then the Hughes Corporation would buy them, and then they'd all split the money. So he has his dark side. On the other hand, I find him to be credible when it comes to talking about Howard Hughes being out of the DI, because we have corroboration of it. We have another fellow that also said he saw Howard Hughes up in Tonopah with John Meyer. We have Howard Harrell, the brothel madam's husband, who says that Johnny Meyer was very close to Beverly Harrell, and that he brought Howard Hughes to the brothel with him on one occasion. So I would not put much credence in what he says, except for the fact that we can corroborate those parts of it.
You know, one of the problems you might get to if you ever got to trial is, and Melvin, you can jump into this in a minute, but Stuart Stein and Ron Greening, I want to ask you first, is that Melvin has not always been truthful about things, and it's something that I guess they could use to impeach him as a witness if it ever came down to it. I'm speaking about the Mormon will, and Melvin's told us a little bit about this earlier. You know, he dropped it off, and then he denied ever seeing it, and then had to admit later that he had lied about that. Is that going to be a problem somewhere down the line?
No, I don't think it's going to be a problem because, A, everybody knows about it. B, that is the only thing that anybody can accuse Melvin of fabricating. And I think it's quite understandable. Let's understand that when Howard Hughes died in 1976, we only had three networks. And we didn't have all of these media consultants out there. Lawyers were not as sophisticated with dealing with the media as we are today. And so the media just came down on people. As Melvin said, he dropped out of school because these people were bothering him in his classes. And so what he did originally was to protect himself from this kind of craziness, and he was getting calls from all over the world. But once the truth came out, no one ever caught Melvin telling another false statement in court or about anything concerning him picking up Howard Hughes. So like everything else, when you have a case and you have a weakness, and I don't really consider this a weakness, you bring this up on your own case. Melvin, did you not tell the truth about that? Yes, I did, just as he did on the show here today. And all of the people listening to Coast to Coast AM tonight would be able to tell just by the tenor of Melvin's voice, and if we were on television, they would see by the way he conducted himself when he would tell this and admit that he lied, he knew that he did wrong, and he came forward and he admitted it, and he moved forward with his life. So
Melvin,
I don't think that's going to be a big problem.
Melvin, you want to explain not telling the truth about that part of it?
Well,
the main thing there is because there was so many unanswered questions for me, because I didn't know why Levain Forsythe had left the thing with me. He didn't give me any instructions. I didn't expect it. And just from reading it, I'm not an attorney or anything, and know a lot about wills and stuff, but I, you know, just the way it was written, I thought that they were going to accuse me of writing it, and I didn't want it, that to be happen, and I didn't want them to accuse my family of writing it, which they did too. And I, you know, when they said a mysterious woman had dropped it off at the church, I thought, well, if that's what they think, I'm just going to go along with it. And that's, you know, I'm sorry I did that. But, you know, that it was just, there was so many unanswered questions, you know, because I knew that they'd ask me, well, who was it, this guy that dropped it off to you? Where'd he come from? And why did he bring it to you? And I didn't know all those answers, you know, at the time. I had no clue why he brought it to me, and he didn't tell me to take it to the church. I did that because it was on the envelope. It wasn't instructions to take it to the church, but it was addressed to David O. McKay, and I knew he was the president of the church. So,
for the record, Melvin, you don't look anything like a mysterious woman. At least when I saw you.
Yeah, they accused me of wearing high heels and everything else. Sure,
that would have been a good disguise. Hey, Ron Greening, your strategy for tomorrow, I mean, if everything goes well, what could you accomplish tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we would actually delay a further hearing until we've had the opportunity to depose the additional family members who are still wanting to take over the management of the Gay estate and oust the independent administrator that's been appointed by the court. So tomorrow we're looking to proceed toward justice by being able to depose a couple of the Gay family members. We had noticed them for deposition, and they didn't show last Monday.
But I mean, these guys could keep dragging. I mean, there are still other options they would have just to make you jump through new hoops and drag it out and drag it out.
There are no better hoop jumpers than Ron Greening and Stuart Stein. They can put up as many as they want, and we're going to go and jump through them because we see the end, and the end is going to be before a jury in Utah to really get to the bottom of this.
All right. Stuart Stein, Ron Greening, Gary Magnuson, Melvin Dumar, hang in there with us. We've got some time left, and maybe we'll get to some questions if we can work out our technical bugs. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, everyone. Thanks for hanging in there with us. We did have some technical problems, and our crack intrepid staff there at Premier Radio's Coast to Coast staffers have figured it out. We had Melvin Dumar in Utah, Gary Magnuson, I think, in Arizona, Stuart Stein in New Mexico, Ron Greening was in Texas, and all four of those guys, four different lines in four different states. It was sort of overtaxing the system. So Ron Greening, who's got to be in court tomorrow, has agreed to drop out of the rest of the conversation. We appreciate him being part of the show and his contributions, but we'll be back in just a moment. We think we got this figured out, and you can ask your questions of Melvin and Gary and Stuart when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're chatting with Melvin Dumar, Gary Magnuson, and Stuart Stein, and we do have a caller on the line, Hiram in Utah, up there in your neck of the woods. Melvin, Hiram, are you there?
Yeah, sure am.
What's your question? Good morning.
Well, back in 76, 77, I was in high school, and a man stopped by our home and was a good friend of my dad's, and came in, and they were catching up, and then he asked him what he was doing. He got all secretive, and he said, I work with Howard Hughes, and he says, I'm with him every day, and he says he just surrounds himself with Mormons because he trusts them, but he won't let anyone else in there. And he went on and told my dad some incredible stories. I was just sitting there, you know, listening, and I wondered if these gentlemen had pictures and names of some of his aides that, you know, on a website or something I could look at and try to figure out who this guy was.
Gary, why don't you tackle that one?
I only have a photograph of one of them, and that's Howard Eckersley. Do you recall any of the names? Or,
that's what I don't know, but I'd never forget his face.
Well, can you give us a physical description?
He was tall, had almost white hair, real strong build, real intense man.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it could be Eckersley. He was the tallest of the group.
Well, there are, you know, there is a photo of Eckersley, as I recall, in your book, Gary, and you know, there are some websites that would have some of the folks who worked for Hughes.
Yes.
All over the web. So, Hiram, maybe you can send Gary an email or something. I think his connection info is on there, and he can talk about this.
Well, my dad died just a couple of years later, so I was never able to ask him about it. So I'll try that. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go west of the Rockies. Joseph in Alaska. Good morning,
Thank
Joseph.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm Joe Princiota. I'm the official sculptor of Howard Hughes. When he died in 76, they asked me to create something. I created a series of solid gold medallions with his likeness on it. I worked for Nadine Hensley directly and Bill Gay.
Wow. I see.
Matter of fact, Bill made some changes on the last minute of the sculpture there. But my point is, I'm just endorsing what you say, because when Will Lummis came through about the time that we had finished within the one-year anniversary of Hughes' death, we'd finished the medallions, and they were supposed to be given out. There's 999 of them. They weigh 18 ounces of 11 ounces, I think it is, of 18-karat gold. I'm trying to remember now. I've got a couple of them here. Point is, the fight you're talking about was very active. Lummis and the family wanted money. They wanted the medallions sold. Bill Gay wanted the medallions given out to the people who were significant in Hughes' life. And so they ended up, I think, in a vault, a few floors below Flamingo Road there.
Uh-huh.
In the office in Summa, and I don't know what finally happened to them. One silver is given out every year to the Aero Club. My point is, Nadine Hensley told me personally Howard started many wills and never really finished any that she was aware of. She kept after him to finish them, and he hadn't. And the real absence of any kind of documentation is what caused a lot of that mess. I hope you guys are able to come through this. When Levain came and showed up, he had come from Anchorage. And they knew me, of course, working on the sculpture. I had apartment in Anchorage, and they interrogated me for the better part of a day.
Did you ever speak to Levain Forsythe about the will or any of that stuff?
No, I'm sorry that I don't have anything I can really add. I've sent you an email with the websites where my artwork is shown. My website is bodymap.com, BODYMAP.com, and you can look at my artwork and my other stuff there. I've had 35 years in court. I'm a professional forensic communicator. I do jury work, jury selection, and evidence presentation, and I sculpt very accurately for medical malpractice, and that's why they hired me. They said, we don't want anything artsy, so I did a photorealistic sculpture of him on the day the spruce goose, which doesn't have a lot of spruce in it, flew. He took off his tie. There's a certain look in his face, and that's what's on the medallion. I can get you guys copies of the sculpture that was original from which the medallion was made, and I'd like to offer that for the work you're doing. We'll get you some copies. My email's been sent out, but I sure appreciate tonight's program. It so accurately is representing the fight and the pressure that the Hughes Corporation was able to put on in the Las Vegas time during those years. I lived there from 75 to 89.
Hey, Joseph, let me ask you this. Do you ever get an indication from any of that, from Nadine, from Levain Forsythe, that Howard Hughes could have gotten out of the DI, had been out at any point? Ever hear any even scuttlebutt within the company about that?
Yes. And I have to say yes, and I have to say Nadine. She would say, she used to start her sentences, "Oh, darling," and I'd say something, because they initially put me in a room with films of Hughes where I could select any image I wanted, and they produced them for me. Then they put me in touch with all of the board directors that could reach me for their anecdotes. I was trying to get a sense of personality for the sculpture. She would meet with me about once a week, and we'd talk about it as his face was developing. Then she would tell me more about him personally. She wanted me to wipe out the eyelid on the lower part of his eye because she says, "Oh, darling, his eyes were so soft, you know. You got to make them soft, you see. And then she'd tell me little stuff. I signed no agreement for confidentiality, so I don't feel, but I was going to do an interview, national television, about it, with a, I'm trying to remember the fellow in L.A. Who was going to have me on TV, and the Hughes Corporation squashed that really quick.
Well, Joseph, we appreciate you calling in. Gary, you're probably going to want to talk to this guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I definitely will. I'll be in touch with you.
Yeah, I've sent you the email already.
Let me just ask you one question. One question, if I could. Who was it that pressed you so hard about
Forsythe?
Yeah.
Oh, it was Gay directly.
Was it?
Oh yeah. I was in a room with about three other guys. Fred Lewis Nabo had just taken over publicity for the Hughes Corporation. As Hughes died, the fellow who had it for so long, I'm trying to remember, was an older man, heavy set. Had the PR responsibility, and Fred Lewis was taken on as a as an employee from one of the hotels, and his job was PR, and he had me under his wing. And there was a we produced the medallions back in Danbury, Connecticut, and there was a time on the road to the Danbury Mint on our second or third trip where he had the car pull off to the side of the road, and he asked me to step out of the car, and he said to me at that point, Fred Lewis said, "You know, we've given you a special job here. Don't mess us up." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you can't. We're paying you a certain price, and we've elevated your work, and we've told you stories, and you've learned things. And you know, be respectful of the gift we've given you." It's just what he said. We got back in the limousine and we drove on.
And you understood what he meant.
Oh yeah, but it's 32 years later, and this is a terrific radio
right.
show. I'm so glad to hear
right.
you guys talking about it. I wish you luck.
Thank you, Joseph.
Thank
Fred
you.
Lewis. Fred Lewis, by the way, was an anchor man, and I think he was news director at KLAS-TV here where I work in my day job. Interesting guy. We're going to go see if we can get a couple of more calls in. East of the Rockies, Russ in Buffalo was the guy we were trying to get to when all this stuff started. You there, Russ?
Yeah, that was pretty crazy, huh? I only have one question. This Mr. Darrow that he was mentioned, the man who flew the plane and he worked for Howard Hughes, how come he didn't come forward like 30-some years ago?
Well, can I grab that, George?
Sure.
Darrow was, when he left the Hughes organization, he was required to sign that non-disclosure matter. And so he was prohibited by law from doing this. Now,
he got promoted. He didn't get fired. He thought he was going to get fired.
Yes, he didn't get fired. And what happened was, and this is something fairly typical when we're talking about super wealthy people, that they don't want to fire people when they do something wrong. And the organization felt that when he took Howard Hughes up there and he took that nap and he didn't bring him home directly, that was wrong. He expected to be fired, but he never was. He never spoke to Howard Hughes again. But what happens in those kinds of situations is that they laterally move these people around in the organization, and he was technically promoted to running the Howard Hughes organization over at McCarran Airport, the airport that everybody flies into now. And then later on, he was offered this position as the vice president of the bank was owned by a good friend of Howard Hughes. So he always felt that it was Howard Hughes that promoted him up and then out of the organization. And he was, as you know, George mentioned earlier, that Bob Darrow was very respected in the Las Vegas area. Everybody knows who he is. And as I said to him, and as I said in court, that as we all get older, when we have these things about our lives, and we know that we know the truth, that we want the truth to come out before it's our time to visit God in the face. And that's how he feels. He is a very honorable man, and he is a very thoughtful man. And he, when he found out, as was mentioned earlier, when that article appeared in the Review Journal for the very first time, mentioning that Lida Junction and the Cottontail Ranch were involved, that's when the lightning struck him and he knew that he had to speak up. And, you know, that's why we're doing this show today, because we feel that there are many other people out there that know the truth that want to speak up. And that's why if, you know, we're looking for Sonny or other people that may be connected with the Hughes organization that know that he left the Desert Inn but felt compelled not to come forward because of that confidentiality agreement. We just want them to contact us at info@steinlawfirm.com or just contact Coast to Coast AM, and they'll forward it over to us, or either to me or to Gary, and we'll follow it up.
Thanks, Russ. Thanks for that call. First-time caller line, George in Arizona. Good morning, George.
Oh, hello. I've been trying to bring some justice, provide justice to this man, Melvin. I used to have a talk show program in Utah, KTKK, with Sherlock K. Collins. And this gentleman, Melvin Dumas, used to call. And at the beginning, I thought that this man, you know, was a cook, you know, just crank calls, whatnot. But then as he kept repeating, you know, his calls, you know, to my show, then I realized that there was something about the voice of this man, in his voice. I knew that he spoke of something that had to be the truth, the story. But the story that he was trying to share with others, reaching out to anybody that would listen to him, was too great. Melvin, you still don't know. You have no idea what you stumbled into as a consequence of your running with Howard Hughes, that great, most brilliant genius of the 20th century. Anyways, Melvin, I do believe your story. I always have. But you remember, do you recall Melvin calling Sherlock A. Collins and myself, Hungarian George? I told you that you are up to a force, a powerful force.
Well, let's let him answer the question.
You will never understand, and that is the Masonic factor.
Okay, George, hold on. Let's let Melvin answer that question. Melvin, you know what this guy's talking about?
Well, I don't recall ever calling in any radio station or anything, but I do know that... this goes way beyond what Stuart and Ron and them are doing. It reaches way beyond that. It reaches practically every American.
You're talking about some Masonic stuff?
No. I mean, because of the taxes and everything else and what went on and who was involved. I mean, you know, I'm just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, that sounds like we'll have to get into that in another show. Thanks for calling, George. We've got time for one more caller. West of the Rockies, Shelley in Vancouver. Shelley, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, God bless you, Melvin, and your search for justice. I just wish you all the best and your team. My question is, following your story, which has just kept me intrigued for this whole time, I have one question, and that is, does anybody know how he ended up on that road that you found him on?
You know, he never told me what he was doing there or how he got there. But, you know, the way the situation turned out, I always thought that somebody had just brought him out there and dumped him. But I don't know. From what I can remember, he never told me what he was doing there or how he got there.
Gary, you think you got a ride, right?
On that.
Go ahead.
The pilot was asleep in the kitchen. Howard Hughes came out of the room, Sonny's room. He probably asked around, "Where's my friend?" Nobody knew because the pilot had spoken directly to Beverly Harrell. So Howard Hughes probably thought that he had left him or something had happened to him. So he went outside. There were some people in the bar, some men in the bar. Maybe one of those men followed him out, offered him a ride, and drove down the road a piece until they found that dirt road, pulled off the road, smacked him in the side of the head, and took his money. When Melvin found him, and Melvin should describe it to you, he had dried blood caked on the side of his head and in his hair all the way down to his shoulders. So he had been injured in one way or another, and that's only speculation on my part, but it makes sense.
Thanks, Shelley. Was that your question? I think Shelley's gone. let's try to wrap it up. We got a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering, for one thing, Levain Forsythe, that deposition that he gave seems so important. Stuart, would you be able to enter that in the new trial, his deposition, or would it have any weight at all?
Well, there's going to be some evidentiary questions on whether we could or not. We may be able to do it to support the position of Melvin's testimony that this is the guy who did show up, and we may be able to get it in because he is now dead, and confirm that. But that is, really part of our proof of the fraud. In other words, the proof of the fraud that somebody threatened him. The only persons who would have an interest in threatening Forsythe from coming to the trial would be the people who were opposing the will being entered into evidence, and that's Mr. Gay and Mr. Lummis, or people acting on their behalf. And so therefore, the way we get that in indirectly is to get Melvin's lawyers, who are still alive, and get them on the stand to talk about the conversation they had with him the night before, and that he wouldn't testify, and how important his testimony was. And that would be proof that he was threatened to be away, threatened away from the trial, and that the jury could make a conclusion, the jury that we'll have in Utah could make a conclusion that that was extrinsic fraud against Melvin's interest perpetrated by Mr. Gay and Mr. Lummis. And that's how we can get it in indirectly.
Okay, Stuart Stein, thanks you. Thank you for the great job you're doing on behalf of Melvin. Gary Magnuson, author of The Investigation, any final thoughts?
No, I think this is good. If anybody knows of Sonny, please get in touch with us. We would love to speak with her or whatever information you might have about her.
Okay, and Melvin Dumar, thanks, man. Thanks for being with us, and you hang in there.
Yeah, thank you.
And let me know how things are going for all of you. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be back next Friday night with more Coast to Coast AM. Good night, everyone.